Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio Show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Marie Pasinski of Harvard Medical School. A renowned brain expert, Dr. Pasinski is dedicated to increasing public awareness concerning the importance of adopting a brain-healthy lifestyle, as our brain is the true source of our vitality and happiness. Dr. Pasinski and I will be discussing how we can redesign and energize our brain at any age. Good morning, Dr. Pasinski. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Johnny, for having me on.
I'm excited. It's a pleasure to have you on the air with me. I enjoyed reading Boost Your Brain Power. The information is very educational, and I'm looking forward to our discussion. Congratulations.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. Well, so I'm a neurologist at Mass General Hospital in Boston, and I absolutely love what I do. And I realize how lucky I am to be able to do what I do, because looking back, I was incredibly fortunate to have this opportunity. Back when I entered high school, my guidance counselor actually told my parents I wasn't college material because I had performed so miserably on the placement exam.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of taking the regular college prep curriculum, the guidance counselor wanted me to take remedial reading. And back then, if you didn't take a foreign language, you could never go on to a four-year college, let alone medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, you know, just really believed in me and said, "I know you can do it." And it's amazing to me how a single comment can be life-changing. And she insisted that I take the regular college prep curriculum in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, she changed the whole course of my life.
That's very interesting. Did you all have the conversation in the kitchen by chance? I'm just kidding.
You know, I think the best conversations are in the kitchen, and that's where we always used to talk.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So what got you interested in the study of the human brain?
Well, I first became interested in medicine through my brother.
Mm-hmm.
I was when I was in college, he was just starting out in medical school, and he was really excited about what he was learning. And he was taking gross anatomy, where you dissect
mm-hmm.
a human body. And he said, "You know, Marie, you've got to come see my cadaver." And I thought, "I don't want to come see your cadaver." And at the time, I didn't really know, you know, where I was headed. I was doing mm-hmm. a lot of art classes and, you know, wasn't really sure if I wanted to go see his cadaver. But
mm-hmm.
we went over to the medical school one night, and he showed me how they were dissecting the upper extremity, and how if you
mm-hmm.
pulled on some of the tendons in the forearm, the fingers would flex.
Mm-hmm.
And if you pulled on others, the fingers would extend. And from my art background, you know, for me, it was like Leonardo da Vinci's anatomy drawings coming alive. And that was a real epiphany for me, a real turning point
mm-hmm.
where I thought, wow, you know, the human body is just so amazing. And I really wanted to learn more. And then when I myself was actually in medical school and taking gross anatomy, the very last part of the dissection is removing the brain. And I'll always remember the first time I held a human brain in my hands, and to think that, you know, every memory
mm-hmm.
this person ever made, every experience was encoded within this organ, you know, every feeling that they ever had. And it's a very memorable moment for me. And, you know, I find the brain endlessly fascinating and absolutely love what I do.
That's fantastic. It's sort of basically holding a hard drive in your hand.
Yeah, it is. You know, and it's just such a such an incredible miracle, the human brain, all of its capabilities. And I think what's so meaningful to me as a neurologist is to realize that nothing will have a greater impact on the quality of our lives than having our brain functioning at its best. And that's what I love sharing with patients the most, telling them what they can do to keep their brain healthy, vibrant, and, we only have one brain and it has to last a lifetime. And there are things we can do to improve its function and to enjoy our brain.
Very interesting. So how did the book Boost Your Brain Power come about?
Well, it was a very interesting collaboration between Amy Newmark, the publisher for Chicken Soup for the Soul, and Harvard Medical School. And so they collaborated, and I love the idea behind it. So it's a combination of short stories in the typical Chicken Soup for the Soul fashion. Mm-hmm. And then what I do is I write the medical advice behind the stories. And I think for a book on how to boost your brain power, it's just such a terrific concept because stories are very memorable. Mm-hmm. We're much more likely to remember information that comes to us through a story, not to mention it just makes it more interesting and fun. Mm-hmm. And I just think this series of books collaborating between Harvard Medical School and Chicken Soup for the Soul is really brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's a very special series, and I'm just thrilled to be a part of it.
Wonderful. What is neuroplasticity?
So neuroplasticity is the most exciting concept in neuroscience. Neuroplasticity refers to our brain's incredible ability to make new neurons and new connections throughout our lives. And so it's never too late to change your brain for the better. Mm-hmm. We used to think the brain was static and that we were born with all the brain cells we'd ever have, and we now realize that was completely wrong. Your brain is constantly changing. In fact, every single experience you have changes your brain. And even as people are listening to us talking today, their brains are changing. And, it really gives us pause to think about, what kind of information we're feeding our brain, what kind of experiences we're having, and how we are shaping our brain over time. The brain we have at this very moment is the result of all the thoughts that we've had, all the experiences that we've had. And again, it's never too late to change your brain for the better. And that's what I find so exciting in neuroscience.
I'm looking at from the standpoint of flexibility in terms of if you don't think a whole lot, if you're not exposing yourself to new ideas or new way of thinking or new things, then your brain, I guess, in this case, instead of growing new neurons, is just static.
It is. You're just kind of treading along the same thought pathways. Mm-hmm. So every time you think in a new way, you actually have to think along a new pathway. Thoughts are a physical thing. I think often we kind of think of them as just, being this kind of hazy, they're not physical, but every time you think a specific thought, you are stimulating a pathway from neural point A to neural point B. Mm-hmm. And what's remarkable about the brain is that the more you think along that pathway, the stronger it gets.
I'm glad you brought up the concept of that physical path of thoughts, because I like reading that section in the book in terms of really telling us how the brain functions and ideas forming and feelings exist in the brain in a series of electrical chemical reactions and so forth. So can you kind of elaborate on that a little bit more, because I really like that chapter.
Mm-hmm. So again, when we think of a thought, we're stimulating a very specific pathway in our brain. And the more we think along that thought, the stronger that pathway becomes. And this is how habits are formed, both good habits and bad habits. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you're stressed and if you're worried about something and you keep thinking this worrisome thought, that pathway of that negative worrisome thought is becoming stronger and stronger every time you think along it. And it becomes a vicious cycle. But the good news is that you can learn to think in new ways and refuse to think along those negative pathways. And when you refuse to think along them, they wane over time. I like to think of it as a pathway that becomes overgrown with weeds because it's not being walked upon. It's not being used. And on the other hand, when you make yourself think new, self-enhancing, positive pathways, you literally are making those pathways stronger. So when you think a new positive thought, you literally are forging a new pathway in your brain. And the more you think that positive thought, the stronger it becomes. And over time, it becomes your go-to thought. You know, the more you think along it, the more you reinforce it, the more likely you are to think that thought. And so in this way, we really can remodel and change the infrastructure of our brain.
That's very interesting. So you were telling us that we can use this to boost our brain power by just changing the way we think, because our thought mm-hmm. process basically connects to our entire body, obviously. So if we want to sort of channel our energy in a positive way, then we need to do that versus letting fear overcome us and then thinking in a negative way, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing we realize is that our thoughts, the way we think, physically does change the rest of our body. And some of the most exciting research on this is from Dr. Herbert Benson, who also is at Massachusetts General Hospital. And he's done research where he took a group of people and taught them what's called the relaxation response, learning to relax their mind and think and use their brain in a certain way mm-hmm. for 20 minutes every day. And he did that over the course of 8 weeks. And he looked at their white blood cells mm-hmm. before and after the eight-week period. And we have this amazing technology now where we can see how we can look at the genes within a cell and tell whether they've changed their activity. Genes are either turned on or turned off. And what he found was that just in 8 weeks of doing this relaxation response for 20 minutes every day, the genes in people's white blood cells changed for the better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he couldn't look at all 20,000 genes, but when he looked at a lot of the genes involved in the stress response and in inflammation, which plays a role in aging and many diseases, mm-hmm. those genes were down-regulated. So, you know, it's just amazing to think that the way you use your brain physically changes the white blood cells that are circulating in your body. To me, it's just, I think, the most important research that's been done, because it really establishes that mind-body connection, that the mind, mm-hmm. you know, has a very
yeah.
strong and an effect that we can demonstrate on our body.
Very interesting. So are there activities that you recommend people do to improve their memory?
Mm-hmm. So memory, first of all, let's just talk a little bit about memory. I think most mm-hmm. of us, when we think about memory, we think of it as things we want to remember. But memory is the basis of everything that we know, from like riding a bike, to driving a car, to recognizing people, to recognizing words. So it's such an incredible skill, and that's what gives meaning to our lives, because if we couldn't mm-hmm. remember anything, we could never learn anything. And memory is like any other skill, that the more you use it, the better it becomes over time. And many of us don't realize that as we get older, we don't really use or challenge our memories, and mm-hmm. certainly not the way we did when we were young. I often ask people to, you know, think about when you were in school. You know, you were just constantly going new places, meeting new people, learning new concepts. you know, opening yourself up to new experiences, learning new skills. So your brain was inundated with all this new information that you basically memorized to learn all these things. And so your memory was getting this incredible workout. And as we get older, we tend to, you know, get stuck in our routines, a routine way of living. You know, we get caught up in our, you know, in our lives, in our work, in our families. We tend to solve the same kind of problems, spend our weekends the same way, and we're not tapping into, you know, the incredible possibilities that are out there to challenge our mind with new experiences and new learning. And in that way, you are using your memory.
Are these activities, do they help in reducing the risk factors for dementia and Alzheimer's in some ways?
Yeah, there are studies showing that staying mentally active and challenging your mind is associated with better cognitive function as you get older. And lower rates of dementia. So it's just so important. And I think, you know, too often we think of, you know, to improve our mind, we have to maybe take a college course or something, you know, something really hard and challenging that's kind of dull. And it really shouldn't be that way. What I encourage people to do is to pick up a new hobby or skill. And it doesn't matter what it is. As long as it's something that you love and you're passionate about it, because when you're passionate about something, that actually primes the brain for learning. It releases this neurotransmitter called dopamine, which helps us remember. Mm-hmm. Now, that's why, you know, back when you were in school, you were more likely to learn from a teacher that you found interesting, you know, someone that you liked, someone who had a fun class. That's going to make you retain the information more. So why not, you know, spend our time now learning, you know, new things that we really want to learn and that are fun and it will enrich your life. And the other wonderful thing about it is these are activities and skills you can share with other people. And we know that spending time with other people and having a rich social network also keeps the brain healthy.
Your book talked about retaining memories. And also about the fact that there are people that loses memories because of hitches and glitches. Why do people suffer from memory hitches and glitches?
Mm-hmm. So again, often we don't realize it, but we're not really challenging our brains or our memories as we get older. So that's one thing I recommend is that people, you know, really challenge their mind, you know, take up a new activity. One of the women in the book wrote this short story about how she took up improv acting and how that really challenged her mind. And she found, you know, in other areas of life, you know, she felt she was sharper. I have a patient who, she's in her mid-40s, and she was complaining of, you know, gee, my memory's not as, you know, sharp as it used to be. She's having trouble finding words. And like I do for everyone, I suggested that she, you know, try taking up something that she loved. And, well, she always wanted to sing. So she took singing lessons. Mm-hmm. And in the process, she had to memorize the words to all these songs. Mm-hmm. And she found that her memory for other things also improved. So that's one thing is to, you know, challenge your memory, use it. And then the other thing is another reason we often have these hitches and glitches is that we're often just not really paying attention or listening when information is coming in. We're distracted. And so if you don't pay attention, it's never going to stay in your memory because memory kind of works sequentially. You have to first register it immediately, you know, pay attention, and then it goes from what's called short-term memory then into long-term memory. And things that help it move to short-term memory or on to long-term memory are repetition. And also we're much more likely to remember something if it's unusual or something memorable, something that we've never seen before or heard before, something that's ridiculous, something that has emotion to it, we're much more mm-hmm. likely to remember. And so there are different tricks we can use to kind of weave those into the process when we're trying to make memories that help.
I find myself having major problems in short-term memory, and I'm talking about meeting someone and then forgetting their name afterwards.
It's so common. I hear that a lot, and mm-hmm. and it happens to me too. And I find when it happens is when I'm not really paying attention. You know, I'm meeting mm-hmm. someone, but I'm also thinking, oh, I've got to say hello to that person over there, or mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, your mind is elsewhere. So taking the time to really listen and then repeat the name as often as you can. And if you can make a mental association with that name, that will help you remember it better too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there have been some interesting studies on this. When we're able to visualize a word, that makes it more memorable. For example, if you meet somebody, say, and they're introduced as this person is a butler, we tend mm-hmm. to kind of picture a butler in our mind, and that mm-hmm. makes it stick. Where if you just say, this is Mr. Butler, mm-hmm. it probably would just kind of not stick in your memory.
Mm-hmm.
But if you mm-hmm. can make associations like that and visualize it, that definitely helps. I'm a big fan of visual memory.
The brain do want you to take a little snapshot because it's very visual in some ways.
Mm-hmm. But we kind of take for granted the power of our visual memory. You know, when you think about it, like one example I like to give is our ability to recognize faces. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. You know, we recognize thousands and thousands of faces from people that we grew up with, went to school with, mm-hmm. People that we work with, family, relatives, neighbors, the people we buy our coffee from in the morning,
mm-hmm.
Not to mention all the celebrities on TV. It's not that we have to study their faces to recognize them. We just see them, and it's this incredible ability our brain has. You can kind of tap into that power of visual memory when you're trying to remember, you know, words or people's names or a list of things by making visual associations.
That helps the short term as well, I presume, the long term, because I don't have any problems in terms of long term. It's amazing that I can remember things way back when I was a child very vividly, like it's stored in my brain somewhere. When I need to recall it, we talk about the brain being the hard drive, and I'm able to download it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what often is mm-hmm. confusing to people as they get older about dementia.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding people who have memory problems. Typically with memory problems, people have the ability to they lose the ability to make new memories. They start to have mm-hmm. trouble with that. Mm-hmm. So old memories that were made long ago, they can still retrieve those and recall those without any problem. But what they have difficulty doing is remembering more recent memories, because in dementia, what happens, the part of the brain that makes memories is affected first. And so that's what makes that tricky.
How does our lifestyle contribute to our brain well-being?
It's huge. It's so huge. There was a fascinating study by Barnes and Yaffe that their conclusion was that up to 50% of cases of Alzheimer's disease are due mm-hmm. to 7 modifiable risk factors. So, you know, clearly, I mean, 50% is a lot.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
so I think it's so important for people to, you know, to realize that the way they live their life and the lifestyle choices that they make, that has a huge impact on the health of their brain. And again, the good news is that these are modifiable risk factors.
I guess, for lack of a better term here, you need to exercise your brain, because if you don't, then it's sort of stiffened up on you.
Mm-hmm. So cognitive inactivity and low educational attainment, that is a risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
But the other risk factors are smoking, depression, midlife obesity, diabetes, midlife hypertension, and then physical inactivity. So
mm-hmm.
those are the seven risk factors. And I think one of the most, one of the easiest ones for people to change is physical inactivity. Just be more physically active. It's one of the very best things you can do for your brain. And that is because when you get your heart rate up, when you exercise and you feel that flush in your face.
Yeah.
As your heart rate gets up, that's from increased blood flow. And that's when you get your heart rate up, that same flow is happening in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that causes this cascade of wonderful changes in your brain and the release of these brain-boosting chemicals like BDNF, which actually promotes the birth of new neurons.
This is interesting, though. In today's world, people sit a lot more. You're sitting in front of the computer, you're listening to music, you're watching events. Everything is based on just sitting down in front of your monitor. So you may not do the physical side of the equation. Does that count in terms of thinking?
Yes. I encourage people to avoid prolonged sitting. there actually was an interesting study not too long ago showing that when you sit for more than 20 minutes, your blood sugar starts to rise, and what's called your triglycerides, which are unhealthy fats in your blood, start to rise. And just getting up for 2 minutes brings those back down. I used to be guilty of that, where I would sit in front of my computer, for hours on end. And ever since, reading that, and there's been more and more in the literature about this, the importance of avoiding sitting for prolonged periods of time. So what I do now is I set a timer, usually for about every 30 minutes or so, and I just get up for 2 minutes and do some, light activity, or, maybe I'm talking on the phone and I'll stand up, take the phone call standing up. Or, like right now, I'm walking around as I'm talking on the phone with you. And there are just so many little ways we can introduce more physical activity into our daily life, and that's great for your brain.
What I find out from reading the book, I realize also that we live in a closed system, and our body is a closed system. You cannot create order without creating disorder somewhere else. In reflecting with the events in my life, for example, and these are good things. I mean, for example, like you have smartphones where you can store hundreds and if not thousands of phone numbers. And I'm looking at myself the other day, and in reading the book, I realized that what if I were to lose my phone? I can't even call home.
I know.
I mean, it's like, oh my God.
I know that happened to me the other day. I didn't have my phone with me.
Yeah.
And I was trying to call my husband. It was like, what is his cell phone number? And, when you think about it before, those were things we used to just commit to memory.
We had this whole
stash of all these phone numbers. And
right.
We don't do that anymore. So you're right that it's just another example of how it's easy to slip by and not challenge your memory. But that could be something fun to do is, to try to commit to memory the phone numbers of loved ones and challenge your mind. It's just kind of a very easy little thing you could do.
When I was in my other business years ago, this was interesting because I was able to remember up to 9 restaurant locations that we have, the phone numbers by heart. And then when we built the 10th one, I lost everything. It's like, okay, you just hit your 2 gig or 10 gig and you can't have an external hard drive, It was so funny. I was like, oh, no, what's wrong? There's something wrong with me. Coming back to, we're talking about memories and so forth, and again, about the fact that we live in a closed system. Let's talk about some of the memory glitches that we have. When does it become a major concern?
That's a really good question. A lot of people wonder about that. For the most part, as we get older, many people complain of like word finding difficulties or you know, not remembering where they put their keys, simple things. And as long as those things come back to you, I don't worry about them at all. When I start to worry is when someone, say, repeatedly asks the same question and they can't seem to retain the answer. They're not retaining new information. Again, that's a sign that the short-term memory isn't working. When they forget common words or mix them up with each other, so they say a word that's they don't really mean to say, but they don't catch it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that can be a sign. Getting lost while walking or driving around in familiar places. Having trouble doing things that they used to be able, you know, that they used to do, like, you know, just chores, whether it be cooking or gardening or, you know, using the microwave, using the remote for a TV, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Misplacing items in inappropriate places, you know, such as putting, you know, a wallet in the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Another sign can be a change in their mood or their personality. So all of those things are indications that someone should be checked out. And I think it's also really important for people to know that just because someone is having some cognitive problems does not mean an automatic diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many medical conditions and physical conditions that affect our memory. You know, everything from having a low vitamin B12 level to endocrine problems, thyroid problems, depression, sleep disorders, heart conditions, lung conditions, kidney conditions. All of these things influence the way our brain functions and can manifest as memory problems or cognitive function problems. So again, the take-home message is that if someone is having problems, be sure to get checked out. It might very well be a reversible cause, and
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't want to miss that. But I think so often people are afraid of hearing the words, you know, Alzheimer's disease or dementia, that it keeps them away from doctors. And it's so important, you know, to kind of catch things early so we can, you know, maximize their brain function,
right,
whatever the diagnosis does turn out to be.
Well, you mentioned about vitamin B12. You have a story in the book which is very interesting because all she needed was vitamin B12,
mm-hmm.
and that helps her.
Yeah, I love that story in the book because, mm-hmm. again, it shows people that this was a, you know, young woman who started to feel that she couldn't remember things and she was making mistakes and she was worried, you know, that she had Alzheimer's
mm-hmm.
disease, but fortunately she went to her doctor and found out that she had vitamin B12 deficiency, and once she had that repleted and her levels mm-hmm. came up, she was perfectly fine.
You also talk about, which I did not realize this, but you mentioned about the 5 signs of stroke. Can you share that with us? Because I think that's important for people to understand. A lot of times we are slow in catching those kind of things because it's always misdiagnosed in some ways.
Oh, thank you for bringing this up. Yeah, it's, you know, as a neurologist, it's so tragic to me when someone has the signs of stroke and they're not recognized and they're not brought to the hospital emergently, and they miss the opportunity to be treated, because
mm-hmm.
we do have medicines that can reverse strokes. They can break up. Usually a stroke is caused by a blood clot. That's one of the most common causes. And if someone doesn't get in quickly, we can't administer that medicine. So it's so important to be aware of this, the signs of stroke. And the 5 signs, I hope people commit to memory. And it's on page 93 in my book. It can be summed up as walk, talk, reach, see, feel. Again, it's walk, talk, reach, see, feel. And this is something I go over with my patients. And
mm-hmm.
so we'll go through those one by one. The walk refers to, is there a change in someone's walking? Are they off balance? Are they dragging a leg, limping? A sudden change. talk refers to a change in their speech. Is their speech slurred? Are they using inappropriate words, not making sense? Reach refers to, is the person able to raise both arms up over their head, or, you know, do they have trouble raising one of them? That's a sign of weakness, and that's a could be a sign of stroke. C refers to a change in their vision. Is it, are they having difficulty seeing? Are they seeing double? Is there a change in their vision, an acute change that, again, can be a sign of stroke and needs to be evaluated emergently? And the last word, feel, refers to, do they have a severe headache? And if they normally have headaches, is this one different than their usual headache? The headache of stroke would be different in character than their usual headache, and commonly it's a very sudden onset severe headache. Patients will refer to it as, you know, they thought they were hit in the head with a bat suddenly. You know, they're fine, and then all of a sudden they have this whopping severe headache that needs to be evaluated emergently. So again, it's walk, talk, reach, see, and feel. And the sooner someone with a stroke is brought to medical attention, the better they will do. So, you know, call 911 for any of those signs.
And then, of course, too, that when someone is going through this, we're not talking about something like immediately like that person is just like incapacitated. We're talking about someone that may have these symptoms. We don't pay attention to these symptoms when someone is experiencing this, and it may get prolonged for a few hours, perhaps even a day.
Mm-hmm. And it's not only that we might not notice it, but sometimes the patient themselves is not aware of it because, it's the brain that's not working correctly, and it's our brain that allows us to be aware of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so if the part of the brain where awareness lives isn't getting enough blood flow, they might not recognize that their speech is off, that they're walking abnormally, that they're weak on one side. So, being observant and recognizing these signs. And it's just always better to err on the side of caution, you know. So if you're not sure, better to, you know, to call 911 or call your doctor, someone with expertise to decide what to do.
Why is mindfulness and meditation essential in unlocking the brain's potential?
Well, as we talked about before, the way you think and use your brain literally changes its infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so by changing the way we think, and by learning to think positive, self-enhancing thoughts and replacing, you know, negative thoughts, we literally can change our brain, and that changes our whole physiology as well. When we're under stress, our cortisol levels are very high, and cortisol is very toxic to the brain. In fact, it's toxic to the neurons that are really important for short-term memory, those in the structure called the hippocampus. That's where our short-term memory lives. Mm-hmm. And high cortisol levels are toxic to that. And so by practicing mindfulness meditation, we can, in learning relaxation techniques, we can lower our cortisol levels, and that's healthier for our brain.
The next question is what I consider is important, because we're told that as we get older, we need less sleep. Is that true? Or do we really need a really good night's sleep to really boost our brain power?
Sleep is so important for a healthy brain. and most Americans are not getting enough sleep. You know, we learn to run on insufficient amounts of sleep. And what's so amazing, I think, is that we now realize that it's while we sleep at night that we process information. And that's when our memories are made, is during the night when we're sleeping. So if we're missing out on sleep, that can affect our memory. And in fact, when I see patients who are complaining of memory problems, one of the things I always look into is a possible sleep disorder, or the fact that they're not getting enough sleep. Because, again, we know it's so crucial to memory. And there's a short story in the book about someone who has obstructive sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. And they started having trouble with their memory. And again, they thought, this is Alzheimer's disease. And they're kind of nervous about going to see the doctor. But as it turned out, they had this condition called obstructive sleep apnea, where during the night, they're not breathing as well as they should be, and their oxygen levels drop. And those low oxygen levels really do a number on the memory centers of the brain. So just by treating a condition like that can improve memory. But again, a more common problem is people just don't get enough sleep. I know when my kids were young, I used to say, get to bed early so you'll remember what you learned in school today. And they're not that they always follow that advice, but that's what I told them. But there's some fascinating research looking at how we actually lay down new brain pathways mm-hmm. during the night while we're sleeping, and studies looking at if you learn a skill during the day and mm-hmm. then that night you have a good night's sleep, you will perform that skill better the following day without any practice of that skill in between. Just the fact of sleeping on it actually will improve your abilities. Where conversely, if you don't get a good night's sleep, you don't get that boost in performance.
Very interesting. Now, you did that in your book as well, because you mentioned about the preparation that you went through in preparing for your exams.
Yes, yeah. I realized when I was in college in medical school that if I didn't get a good night's sleep, I would not perform as well on exams, and I would not learn the information as well. So what I used to do is I used to often study right before I went to bed, and again, I'd go to bed really early, and what was really neat is I often remember my dreams, and when I was in medical school, I'll never forget, I had these biochemistry dreams, organic chemistry dreams. So organic chemistry is, really challenging course that you kind of have to do well in, and it's all about memorizing these molecules and the structure of these molecules. And I used to have these dreams that were really wild, where there'd be people in my dreams, and they'd be interacting, but superimposed on the people would be these organic molecules, and the electrons would be moving back and forth. And so, in retrospect, now after reading this research of how we learn while we sleep, I realized that my brain was processing that information that I had studied during the day.
That's very interesting, because it's mapping out what it's supposed to be like and sort of created a memory bank for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other thing that's really interesting, they've done these studies where we have the ability through what's called functional MRI to see mm-hmm. what part of the brain is working when someone performs a certain skill or activity. And so after you've learned a skill and you've slept on it, that area of activity has actually moved during the night while you've been sleeping. So, we literally can see that the brain is reorganizing this information and working on it, mm-hmm. kind of like sorting it out during the night, and that will help you retain information better.
That's pretty interesting. It sounds like the old computer where you defrag everything every so often.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, our brains need that downtime for sure. One other thing that's really interesting about sleep, too, is more recent studies, too, have shown that during the night is when beta amyloid, which is a protein that's deposited in Alzheimer's disease, it's a toxic protein that's deposited, that is actually cleared during the night while we sleep. Our brain levels of beta amyloid decrease during the night while we sleep. So, if you're not getting a good night's sleep, you're not getting rid of that beta amyloid.
All these are natural processes to help within the closed system, the balancing of the equation, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. It's important for the homeostasis. So again, if someone is having sleep problems, you know, if someone does suffer from insomnia or just feels that they don't feel refreshed in the morning when they wake up, they should speak to their doctor because it really is a medical condition that needs attention. And, you know, we now have people who specialize in sleep specialists, and I would recommend that they see someone, you know, for that.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the challenges people face when trying to redesign and keep their brain healthy?
I think one of the challenges is that kind of in this day and age, people want immediate results, you know, things that they can see. You know, when we go on a diet, we like to see that we've lost, you know, pounds, and we want things that are measurable and visible. And, you know, when you're changing your brain, that's a slower process, and you might not be able to see, it takes time. You know, it takes time to kind of rewire your brain and make it healthier. But I think it's important to keep in mind that those changes, when you change your brain, that those changes are everlasting and they're profound. And again, that nothing will have a greater impact on the quality of your life. So I really would encourage people to do that and assure them that they will notice improvement over time. You know, if they really do everything they can to keep their brain healthy and to get it to perform at its best. And that's one of the things I love about the book, too, is there are many short stories by people about what they've done to improve their brain function or keep it healthy. And so I think that's inspirational for them.
So what is your favorite story in the book?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. It's really hard to choose. One of my favorite stories, though, is My Traveling Brain by Anna Betty Brack. And she's a woman that I actually know who has an amazing story. She's 88 years old. And she was in a nursing home on hospice care for over a year and eventually left the nursing home, went back to her own apartment, organized things. She's not in a senior living facility. She's actually living in a regular apartment complex. She got a cat. You go into her apartment, and it's like a college dorm room. she has her... you know, her DVD player, her computer, her Keurig coffee maker, her New York Times, and she's a very avid reader. Physically, she can't get out much now, but she is so sharp mentally, and it's because she's so engaged in everything that's happening in the world. She has incredible curiosity. She reaches out to people. She, you know, even though she's living alone, she knows everybody on her floor, and she has a very, you know, wonderful, active social life and stays cognitively active. And so I think she's a real inspiration of how it's so important not to lose that curiosity as we get older. And I think that's the key to maintaining a youthful brain.
Well, what I like about her situation is that she stays engaged. That's when everything works, because if you engage, you're not giving up in life, and you participate, basically. You don't let life pass you by.
Mm-hmm. She's a riot. She's 88. She's on Facebook. she often is emailing me these little cartoons.
My favorite story in there is Don't Forget to Dance, by Teresa Embert on page 79.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because I like ballroom dancing, and I noticed that when you do ballroom dancing, I'm around a lot of seniors, and I find that it's so wonderful to see them on the floor moving, and dancing really challenges you in so many different ways, not only your brain, your motor skills, and everything else all combine into one. So that's what I like about that.
Oh, absolutely. And I agree with you. I'm a dancer as well. And You know, for me, dancing is a celebration of being able to move my body.
Mm-hmm.
And I take jazz classes, and I do ballroom as well. And, you know, the classes, they're an hour and a half, but they go by so quickly, and it doesn't seem like exercise at all. You know, and the music lifts your spirit. You're always learning new choreography, which mm-hmm. is that challenges your brain. It's very social. You know, I think ballroom dancing is great. You're constantly socializing during that. And, yeah, that's wonderful for your brain. And it's a great example of an activity that's fun and challenges your mind. And those are exactly the kind of activities people should try to do. And then not to mention the ballroom dancing has a physical component where, you know, you're getting physical exercise in, which is wonderful for your brain.
Right. Can you share with us Dr. Howard Gardner's research regarding our intelligence not limited to the quantifiable IQ number? And I like this research simply because, and I'm glad that you included this research in the book, because I think when we get to a certain age, or it doesn't matter whatever age we're at basically, but we sometimes confine ourselves to certain limits. And now we have research out there that says that, wait a minute now, let's look at this differently and let's look at yourself and let's reevaluate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're so right. I love Howard Gardner's research. So Howard Gardner is a psychologist at Harvard. And rather than looking at intelligence as simply a number, your IQ, how well you do in math and in English, he looks at he considers all the other forms of intelligence. And, you know, there's a full spectrum of remarkable human brain capabilities that we kind of take for granted and don't realize that too is a form of intelligence. So his multiple intelligences include what's called linguistic intelligence. So that involves a sensitivity to spoken and written language. People who just tend to be good with languages. They can pick up new languages, you know, easier than others. And again, we all have our own strengths and skills. And so what I love about, you know, his idea of this multiple intelligence is that it includes everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have what's called logical mathematical intelligence. So these are people who are good at just analyzing problems logically, investigating scientific issues. There's musical intelligence, which includes, you know, the ability to not only make music but compose it, or an appreciation, you know, of musical patterns, sounds, and rhythms. For some of us, this is easier, you know, than others. And again, it's a form of intelligence. There's bodily kinesthetic intelligence, which includes hand-eye coordination, handling objects. So people who are athletic, you know, or dancers, these are skills involved with control of body movement. Spatial intelligence. Many artists have spatial intelligence, which deals with spatial judgment and the ability to visualize with your mind's eye. There's interpersonal intelligence, which is concerned with the capacity to understand other people, you know, their intentions, their mm-hmm. motivations. There's interpersonal intelligence, which is the ability to understand yourself and really appreciate your own feelings and motivations, as well as naturalistic intelligence, which is being in tune with nature and an aptitude for understanding natural surroundings. And so I just love this idea of, you know, letting people really look at their own brain and their own set of skills in a new way. You know, I think often when we're younger, we're put into these boxes of, you know, you're either perform well academically or you don't. You're either smart or you're not. And what I love about Howard Gardner's work is it makes us appreciate all the other skills. And I guess for me, with my background, mm-hmm. given that I performed so terribly on on that entrance exam in high school and, you know, was told I wasn't college material. You know, I think that's a testament to these other types of intelligence. And and often when the brain does not work so well in one area, it compensates in another. And, you know, looking back on myself, I realize now that I'm a neurologist that, yeah, I was struggling with dyslexia. But back then, you know, that wasn't on people's radar screens. And it was, I think it was really my kind of visual spatial intelligence that allowed me to succeed. And so I really hope everyone has the opportunity to consider, you know, really what their strengths are and to develop those.
Wonderful. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
So I have a website, www.mariepaczynski.com, and there's information about what I'm doing on the website. There are also what are called beautiful brain tips people can sign up for. The book is available on Amazon, as well as Barnes & Noble's book, and also on Twitter. My handle is Dr. Marie Pazinski, and every week I tweet the latest research in neuroscience and neurology. I would love to hear from people.
Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
I think one of the most important things is to realize that, again, that every experience we have changes our brain. And so even if people have listened to this show, the brain, their brain now is physically different than when they started an hour ago, and yours and mine too. And to, you know, to realize that, again, the way we use our brain directly changes its structure. And so in this way, our brain is like a piece of art in progress, a work of art in progress. And it's never too late to change your brain for the better.
Basically, we are the artists to our brain.
Yes. Oh, I love that. That's a very nice way of putting it.
Wonderful. Dr. Pazinski, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Dr. Joan Stinnell Lester. Dr. Lester is an award-winning author and educator. She is a member of a biracial family. Her books are in wide use as college texts and corporate handbooks. Dr. Lester and I will be discussing her passion in writing about issues in the intricacies of family, friends, and work dynamics among people of different races. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Dr. Pazinski, thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you, Johnny.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.